Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to be talking about heirloom seeds and gardening with them with our guest, Jer Gettle. He is the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. They offer nearly 2,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs, the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the USA. And I have a copy of the whole seed catalog from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, and it is the most fantastic seed catalog you're ever going to see. I tell you what, it's lovely, and we'll talk about that catalog, a little about his business as well, and certainly a lot about heirlooms and heirloom seeds, and just growing flowers and vegetables. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. What varieties of heirlooms do you like to grow? Questions about seeds? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jer Gettle joins us from his home and business in Mansfield, Missouri. Jer Gettle, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good to be here today. Really appreciate it. And I'm hoping you're having some good weather up that way.
Yeah, I understand you have a little rain.
Yeah, we're a little drizzly and wet down here and a little cool, but still nonetheless almost a spring day out there.
Yeah, you know what? I have a great old friend, Jerry Apps, who's also quite a writer, and he had a book recently about his gardening experiences, and he said his dad said, never curse the rain. Never be sorry about the rain.
Yeah, it's definitely every once in a while in the middle of summer, we always miss it. And this time of year, we always have plenty, it seems. But.
Well, you've got involved in selling seeds at a really early age, and I found this a very interesting story. So give our listeners a little history here.
Well, I basically grew up in a gardening family in the Boise Valley area of Idaho and eastern Oregon. We were actually right on the border, and our family lived in both states. But I grew up gardening. I grew up with my folks and grandparents gardening, both my grandmother's garden and my aunts and uncles' garden. So I pretty much grew up, my earliest memories were, you know, planting seeds with my folks or my aunts or cousins and grandmothers. And I guess I naturally came about to like gardening. And I also probably learned to read really out of a seed catalog. That was the first thing I can remember looking at as far as anything printed was seed catalogs, you know, in the winter months when it's all cold outside thinking about spring.
I'll tell you what, there's nothing like going through your seed catalog. And we'll get to that in a bit. But you started this business at a very early age. You were 17, were you not?
Correct. Yeah, I just was basically started as a hobby in my bedroom. Even as when I was 4 or 5, 6 years old, I, you know, always dreamed about, you know, someday working for a seed company, somehow, you know, making seeds my life work, even when I was very small. So it's always been kind of my nature, I guess, to be interested in the magic of the seed and also the stories and cultures and traditions that are associated. My grandmothers were one was from European descent and the other was from Mexico, from Mayan descent. And so I kind of grew up with two cultures and learning about how each culture used the seeds and saved the seeds and their recipes and watching my grandmother grow things and then, you know, make the tortillas on the old wood cook stove.
Oh.
All of that kind of the traditions around seeds and food is what I think kind of got me interested in not just the seeds, but the whole way of life, you know, with seed saving and gardening and growing and preserving and the whole thing about, you know, connecting to different cultures through the vegetables and crops.
You know, we just got a call from Raphael who wondered what makes a seed an heirloom seed?
Well, that depends, and you know, it depends on who you're talking to. But in general, it's something that's passed down, like a piece of furniture or jewelry or clothing or whatever it may be, from generation to generation. It doesn't have necessarily a set number of years. Some people say it should be 50 years old. Some people think it's 100 years old. But it's basically a seed that's been passed down through, you know, at least a couple generations, ideally. But Even seeds that maybe are 25 years old, even if they're not maybe technically heirlooms yet, they're definitely on their way to becoming heirlooms if they're a good, you know, open-pollinated variety. F1 hybrid varieties can't be passed down from generation to generation simply because they won't stay true to their type in general. So most F1s, if you save seed out of them, you can't save, the same thing won't happen year after year. You'll get variations in your crop. So out of that F1, you could eventually have a heirloom seed. But an heirloom seed, though, is one that's passed down. It's open pollinated, which means it, you know, it's able to be stable. If you save seed out of it in the nutshell, it means that it will be stable year after year.
Yeah. And it's for your way of thinking, why is it important to save these seeds?
Well, again, the number one reason in my besides the flavor and the taste, of course, is important. But saving the traditions of each individual community, family, region, country, a seed from Japan is important, you know, simply because it's part of their culture. A seed from Missouri is important because it's part of our culture, or Wisconsin, or wherever you live. It's saving part of your identity. It might be your racial identity. It might be your family's identity or your country's identity. So all of these things are, you know, important. And it keeps, you know, traditional recipes alive. If a traditional recipe called for Macintosh apples, for example, sure, you can substitute something else, but it's still not the same recipe that, you know, your great-grandmother would have made.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, this the show is every Friday. I do this show called Garden Talk, and so we have, over time, I've noticed more of an interest in heirloom seeds and in heirlooms. It comes up often on the show. Why do you think there's such a great market for heirlooms these days?
Well, I think there's several different things going for it, but one is, varieties in America had become so, you know, so the same over the years. Everything became less and less as far as diversity goes. All the tomatoes became round and red. You know, the corn all looks the same. The carrots all look the same. And after a while, I think people just got bored with, you know, these boring tasting, boring looking vegetables. Like, I just bought some strawberries the other day. We were in St. Louis and I ate into them, and it's like I might as well be eating a potato. They're just totally, you know, flavorless. I get home. I just got in from our greenhouses, and I was picking strawberries like 10 minutes before you called. And amazing the difference in these old varieties. Like, I was eating old varieties from Japan, for example, and the flavor is like just like a wild strawberry, but the size is, you know, the size of a you know, like a small egg. So that's the thing with the old varieties. You have this intense flavor still there, intense fragrance. When you smell these strawberries that I was just eating, they actually smell like strong strawberry scent. You can smell them before you taste them. You know, the commercial strawberries, they smell like a cucumber. There's no strawberry fragrance there anymore.
So, and you get, you know, as I look through your catalog and some of the history, you get seeds from all over the place. How do you find your heirloom seeds?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that we work. When I first started, we mostly relied, you know, on the internet and different seed organizations, and we still do that a lot. But anymore, we also have so many customers that are traveling and collecting things. When we travel, when we go to China or Japan, when our customers, employees, our friends, associates, everybody's always looking for things now. So wherever we go, we're always looking for things, looking for smaller seed companies that might be specialized in traditional varieties, whether that's Japan or Germany or wherever we go. You know, different people are going all the time. And it's amazing. There's a whole network of people all around the planet that are concerned about their traditional varieties disappearing. So we definitely have a lot of good connections because so many people everywhere we go are concerned about keeping the old varieties alive.
Yeah. And for you, from a sort of a business sense, how do you determine? I mean, you bring these seeds back and try them out yourself? What do you do?
We do. And we have like six, well, more like eight greenhouses. So we're actually growing stuff year round. So as soon as we find something, in most cases, depending on the crop, it goes in the ground almost immediately now. So, for example, I have a pile of carrots here on the desk that, again, were from Japan. We have a bunch of varieties from China being grown right now, different bok choy and cabbages. So as things come in, we might try like 40 different varieties of bok choy that we just found in China or Japan or wherever it is. We pick out the best ones, and then, you know, within a year or two, offer them to our customers.
Well, it's an amazing process. Jared Gettle, our guest today, he's been growing things since he was 3 years old. At 17, he started he printed the first Baker Creek heirloom seed catalog, and he's been in business ever since. Now they offer nearly 2,000 varieties of vegetable flowers, herbs, the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the U.S. So it's great to have him with us. Questions for him, maybe you have questions about a gardening question, or maybe you have questions about particular seeds, or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at collecting and growing heirloom seeds and learning about the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. They have a great catalog. Actually, I have two catalogs. I'm talking with the founder and head of it, Jer Gettle. He's been involved for a long, long time, knows a lot, and certainly he's ready to answer your questions or comments about either his business or about growing plants from seed. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Wayne in Green Bay, Wisconsin, has a question for you, Jer. So let's go to Wayne. Hi, Wayne. Thank you for calling.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me on the air. My question is kind of probably general, but I've just recently started taking this, like, the ends of my celery and that little stump part and throwing them in water and growing celery in my window. And I find that it tastes better when I do it like that because celery doesn't have much taste in that. And I'm big into the outside gardening as far as flowers go, but I mostly have shade. I have tons and tons of shade plants, but I'd really like to grow a few plants in a few spots out in the yard, but I'm kind of scared about trying to get them to start in the house, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions that I might try, like, on tomato, or, you know, you had mentioned carrots. I just thought there was one kind of carrot.
Yeah. You got to take a look at his, at Jer's seed catalog, or his whole seed catalog, Wayne. Thanks a lot for calling. Jer, some comments?
Yeah, as far as gardening in the house, and inside and indoors and greenhouses, the thing that we've been using a lot this winter is grow lights. You can pick them up. They're still expensive, but they're for a small area or for starting plants, they're well worth the investment. For example, peppers, you know, normally take 8 to 10 weeks to be ready to transplant from inside to outside. Under grow lights, we have some going right now with peppers. I just looked at them about 20 minutes ago, and in 32 days, we have peppers that are ready to go from being seeded in the pot to be ready to put in the garden, which right now they're actually going to go into a greenhouse, not a garden, of course, because it's still, getting toward the end of winter. But that shows you how much, you know, you can save by doing a light overnight. And we're only doing about half of the night. But if you have them in the house, you could do 8 hours, you could do 10 hours of light, and that will make your plants basically double, you know, or more in growth by adding grow lights. And if you have a shady yard, the best thing is not to try to do things like tomatoes. They're really challenging to do in minimal sunlight. The best thing you could do is green leafy crops like lettuces. The smaller the plant and the leafier the plant, the better they tend to do. So like lettuce, kale, ornamental kales like the red kales should do fine as long as they get a little bit of sun each day. Yeah. Things like tomatoes, cucumbers, all the fruiting stuff. The fruiting crops, really, you need to have a minimum of about 6 hours of light, a bright sunlight.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Wayne, for calling. Cameron in Madison, we'll turn to you. Hi, Cameron.
Hey, hello. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Okay, so seeds, perfect. So 6 months of the year, I am able to live in Jamaica. I've got some property there. And I brought a bunch of seeds down, and I don't know necessarily the brand or name of the seeds or vegetable variety, let's just say. And I thought, you know, great, the Caribbean sun, it's intense, it's great, there's no winters, these pumpkins are going to be huge. And I handed some out to some of my neighbors. We all found that none of them grew. So my question is I know he talked about bringing seeds in from China and Japan. Have you found that the different soil types affect these seeds?
A lot of it's due to the day length. That's usually what's is the issue. And Jamaica, a lot of times you have to figure out what season you're actually planting in there. And oftentimes, like, for example, peppers will take a lot longer to start producing in Jamaica. But once they start producing, they'll produce for a lot longer time. And on Jamaica in particular, if you email us at our email address, one of our main horticulturists actually lives in Jamaica, and he could give you a lot of tips. He could even talk with you on the phone and get you. He's been farming in Jamaica. He's about 25 years old, but he's been farming. He's like me. He's been farming ever since he was a little kid and gardening. So he could get you a lot of tips on what does well there. He grows a lot of our varieties in Jamaica, but some things from the northern hemisphere are not going to do as well. You're probably going to want to look for more day-length neutral crops. But Richie Ramsey, he's the guy to get in touch with at our company, and he lives in Jamaica at least 9-10 months of the year. So, and he farms there. So just get in touch with him, and he can help you out on all the Jamaican-related questions.
And what's the email address or the
seeds@rareseeds.com, seeds@rareseeds.com, and just ask for Richie Ramsey. And he's an expert gardener and can get you varieties. And he would probably have some seeds he could share with you of some local varieties as well.
Cameron, does that help out?
That does. That helps out a lot.
All right.
But yeah, Richie also has other connections, like with the university and stuff, too. So if he doesn't have the answer, he can put you in touch with other people in Jamaica that have the answers on what crops really do the best. And some things just don't do well there either. You know, that's some things just are never going to do well there. But he could get you helped out on almost everything.
So seeds, and then the @ seeds at rareseeds.com. That's the place to go. Thank you very much for calling, Cameron. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jeremy in Beloit emailed to say he's had good luck with heirloom varieties in his raised beds. He's wondering what you think about using compost tea, maybe the pros and cons of it.
Well, I don't really know any cons other than, depending on what it's made out of, it might not smell the best if you're using it in the house. But as far as using it outside in your raised beds, that shouldn't be an issue. And I mean, we've never had any, we don't use a lot of it, but we do use it here and there, and we've never had any problems. I mean, it's definitely helpful. Anything you can do to feed the soil, though, whether it's, using compost, mulch, and compost tea, all of that stuff, is good to help, especially depending on how rich your soil is. But anything you can do, especially in raised bed, soil tends to be depleted a little quicker due to, the runoff from the water. So anything you could do to add nutrients to the soil is definitely beneficial.
Do you
plus add microbes and so forth.
Sorry, do you use raised beds at all in your growing?
We use a little bit of everything pretty much here. So we have some of our greenhouses have raised beds in them, and some of our outdoor gardens, our flower gardens are raised beds. But other than that, most of our outdoor gardens are just in the ground. But we do have probably about a tenth of an acre of raised beds.
Tell us, it'd be fun just to know the size and, what you've got in your whole operation.
Well, we have about seven greenhouses that are about 30 by 70. And then we have outdoors. We have about probably less than 3 acres total here in Missouri outdoors. And then we also, in California, a gentleman there lets us borrow some land, and we do trials there on about 6 to 8 acres each year. And then a few other little spots as well around the country where we do trials. And then we work with a whole network of farmers who grow seed for us and also do trialing for us independently of our staff.
I kind of like the idea that you have of having a sort of a get-together. Isn't it monthly, isn't it? You bring customers in, they can come in and have a good time?
We do. We have a monthly event here in Missouri, and our big one is in May. Early in May, we have a 2-day event in May, and I can't remember the dates. I think it's 5 and 6, but I might be wrong. Anyway, it's in early May each year, and you can find out information on our website. And that event draws about 10,000 people each year from almost every state, if not every state, and some foreign countries. And then we have little month-to-month events that draw people from Missouri and Arkansas and more regional.
Matt in Sussex, let's go to you next. Hi, Matt.
I'm wondering if you can give me any insight on the pawpaw seeds or trees. There's a lady that seems to have a lot of success in the Milwaukee area, and she gets a lot of fruit. And so I'm wondering, I did a little research. Seems like I might be kind of on the border of the right climate for that, but she seems to grow a lot of fruit or get a lot of fruit from her pawpaw trees.
And she's in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Right next to Lake Michigan. So she probably gets a little environmental help there.
So I don't know what zone you're in, but pawpaws are pretty hardy. I don't know how, you know, they grow them up into central New York and so up through, you know, Connecticut. I don't know what zone you are there in where you're at currently. But I know pawpaws, the biggest challenge we have with them is that most areas, unless you have a lot of flies, they don't pollinate well. So that's our biggest issue here in Missouri. You almost have to hand pollinate them with like a Q-tip in order to get them to set fruit. And that's the number one complaint we hear talking to people everywhere is the trees look good, they flower, but there's no fruit. And unless you live next to somewhere where there's a lot of flies, they tend to not pollinate well because flies are really the only pollinator, and they bloom early, so there's not a lot of flies anyway. So hand pollinating them is essential.
Oh, very interesting. Does that help, Matt?
Yeah. I was actually thinking, I did a little research, and I think there's a pawpaw festival just across the border in Illinois this spring, so I was going to maybe head down there and get any some more information as well, and if nothing else, have a good time.
Grow them in a moist area, you know, with moist soil, and they should do fine as long as if you're close to the Illinois border. I mean, you shouldn't have if you're in southern Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, it's zone 5. Some people call it 4.5, but
yeah, you should be. I mean, that should be actually be perfect. You know, if you're zone 5, you should be perfect pawpaw growing conditions actually. I mean, they grow them into zone 4 sometimes. So, I mean, I don't think you'll have any – I think it could be – if you're having issues, it could be the soil. They like a damp, like, bottom valley area where they get lots of moisture. And they don't mind being a little shaded either.
So there you go, Matt. Thank you very much for calling. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jim in Sauk County. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I have a simple question, I think. If I have a small greenhouse and I want to start experimenting with heirloom seeds, what soil do you use? Do you use different soils in all 7 or 8 of your greenhouses? Or do you buy it in bags? Do you, you know, create it yourself by composting? I'm just curious because I know that affects the outcome of my gardens.
Yeah, what we actually use in our soil in the raised beds, if it's in the greenhouse and we're planting in the ground, we just use our garden soil that's on the ground, amended with compost and manure, and call it good. But if we're actually growing in raised beds, what we put in our greenhouses or in pots, we use a mixture of primarily it's a mixed soil that we get that's been recycled from a place that grows microgreens. So it's what we're currently using. It's something they're going to throw away anyway, because once they're done with it, they can only use it so many times with the microgreens. So what we do is we take this kind of, it's a peat moss-based soil with a little bit of actual soil in it and a few other ingredients like compost, and we take it and we put it in the beds. And then it's really weak soil, but it's really loose, so we add like some calcium and, you know, some compost, and we fertilize it every month. Because it's weak, we use a liquid natural fertilizer, organic fertilizer, in the raised beds. And that does really well. I mean, but the main thing is if you're doing it in beds, you need a really loose soil, like something that's, you know, has something to make the soil loose, you know, compost and something. If you can find a, you know, leaf mulch or peat moss, like a recycle, some place like that we did that's using a growing microgreens and they're getting rid of their soil, a lot of times you can get it really cheap or free.
Oh, does that help, Jim?
Yeah, I wonder, does the soil condition or the soil components, does that affect taste? Do you ever experiment with that?
It does, and we're no experts on it, but if the soil isn't rich enough, if it isn't balanced enough, you definitely, things that are, you know, really good tasting, if the soil's weak, like we've been adjusting the soil and what's in it, and things have definitely tasted better. If the plants look weak, I guess put it this way, if the plants look weak, the flavor is going to be weak as well. So, I mean, if they look super healthy, once we adjusted it and got the right amount of different ingredients in there this winter, the flavor has gotten a lot better as well. So it's basically, if the plants aren't looking healthy, you can also get the soil tested, but, you know, start off with adding all the things that you know that it's going to need and see where it goes. Like, for example, in our greenhouse, we were short on calcium, and once we added calcium, it made a, you know, a difference of day and night.
Hmm. So there you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Bob in Brookfield emailed that he collected a lot of seeds at the end of the growing season last year. He's been storing them at room temperature in glass dishes on a shelf. Would it be advisable to refrigerate them for a while before he plants them outside? Do they benefit from a period of cold temperatures?
Most seeds don't matter if it's normal garden seeds. If it's like a wild wildflower, a lot of those like to be stratified or chilled for a while before you put them out. But if it's things like zinnias and tomatoes and carrots or beets, all your normal garden seeds really don't matter. It doesn't really matter either way.
Let's take another call here. George in Partyville. Hi.
Hi, guys. So I'm really interested in the grow lights. And I was just kind of curious, like, do plants have to, like, go to sleep for so many hours a day, or can you just run your grow light 24 hours a day?
You can grow light 24 hours a day on a lot of crops. There are exceptions, like crops that are daylight sensitive. For example, onions have to have a certain number of hours. If it's a long day onion, they like long hours. If it's a short day onion, they like short hours. There's also crops that are from near the equator that love, you know, short days. They need like a 12 and a 12. But many crops like lettuce, carrot, you know, some carrots are that way as well. But like a lot of the Japanese carrots or the, you know, typical orange carrots, they don't mind a long day. And by doing a 20, we have grow lights going right now. And by doing a, like, we're not actually doing a 24-hour day. We're doing probably like an 18-hour day. But we are getting carrots in like 50% of the time it takes to get a normal carrot by having those extra hours. Think of Alaska. In Alaska, the produce grows really quick where they have the really long days. So crops that like the long days, which is a lot of crops, you can get double the growth and with the long days. It basically is mimicking the conditions in Alaska in the summertime.
It's amazing. I have a friend, Pam Yonke, who's a broadcaster on a commercial station, and she was just couldn't believe it when she took a crew of people to visit Alaska in the summer to see the crops. The vegetables and how they grew. And, you know, when you got sunlight like that, you're going to get a lot of growth and a lot of maturity quickly. For sure. No doubt about it. George, does that help?
Yeah, that helps a lot, actually. So if you use, like, an average of, say, 18 hours of grow light, that would be great.
It depends. You can use more. The problem is with grow lights, even the LEDs, the amount of electricity that they take is still expensive. So you got to balance how much you're willing to spend on electricity on how fast you want it to grow. So you may want to do it 3 hours additional a day, or you may want to do six. So it's kind of a balancing on how much you're willing and how dark you have your conditions. If you have a really bright day, it may not need any grow lights at all that day, even in the winter. But on many days in the winter, it can be overcast, cloudy. You may need to run the grow light the entire day that day. So it's kind of balancing it out. Ideally, if you could have, you know, either sunlight or grow light for about, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, ideally to minimally would be great. But if you put the grow light longer, you'll get your crops quicker. Some crops, though, don't like the long days. So, but, you know, things like basil in the wintertime, you can get basil in the wintertime almost instantly by using grow lights. And things like growing squash under grow lights, though, on that, again, on the other hand, doesn't really make much sense financially because of the cost of the electricity. But things like basil, quick-growing greens, you know, some flowers, smaller crops make more sense as far as the financial side of it.
Oh, there we go. George, thanks a lot for calling. Chad emailed to say he's rebuilding his garden area, which has all raised beds. Presently, he uses a weed barrier in between the beds, which is not working. He'd like to remove the barrier and plant something in between the beds that can be controlled, a grass or something. But he's concerned that a grass, for example, would spread into his beds. Any ideas or suggestions?
On that, we do something similar here in Missouri. We get tired of, you know, cultivating in between our rows, And so what we actually do, usually we kind of play around with what grasses we use, but we usually plant like an annual ryegrass, and then we mow it. So we mow the grass, the ryegrass, and it lasts most of the season, actually. And it keeps a nice green walk path, and it dies out at the end of the season. So that's pretty easy. But look for annual grasses. But you could also use perennial grasses as long as they're not aggressive, as long as you can till them out and they will die over the winter. But annual grasses are more guaranteed. You know, like an annual ryegrass, plant it thick. You get a nice bed to walk on. And it helps, add compost to the soil.
That's a great idea. I love that idea. Well, thanks very much, Chad, for that email question. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. And before we get to Ron and Madison and other callers, let's go back to the catalogs for just a minute. You have actually two catalogs. One, it's absolutely gorgeous that I have in front of me, and you have to sell that one. I mean, it is packed with wonderful photos and great stories and information. I think, what does it sell for, $10 or something like
Correct.
That?
Correct, yes, yeah. About $9.95.
Yeah, and then you have another one that's sort of online and downloadable.
We do, and they can request it free on our website. Unfortunately, our printed catalog just ran out for the year, the free printed one, and it's about 150 pages versus about 350 pages for the big one that we sell. But both of them have a lot of content. But you can request one for 2020, but we're all out of the free one. You can also, if you don't want to buy it, you can browse it in a lot of stores like Barnes & Noble. A lot of your grocery stores also have the whole seed catalog as well. So you can take a look at it everywhere from like Whole Foods or just different any shopping stores. They have newsstands. If they have a good selection of cooking or gardening type magazines, they'll usually have it. And you can take a look and you don't even have to buy it. You can just browse it for free if you want.
Yeah, it's the title is The Whole Seed Catalog, and then the subtitle, From Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. It is really a beautiful catalog.
Some libraries get it as well, so sometimes you can browse it at the library as well. So.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Ron in Madison then. Ron, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up on the grow lights, especially if you're not doing it 24 hours a day. It's cheapest to use the electricity, the lowest cost, when the fewest people or the smallest amount of electricity is being used in your region. Generally, that's 1 to 4 a.m. for Monday through Friday and about 2 to 5 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday because people stay up later and get up later. The lowest consumption shifts a little bit for weekends and holidays. Now, you can look it up yourself, anybody worldwide, actually. I'll just briefly read this, all lowercase. energyonline.com/data, D-A-T-A. That will get you to the main page. For us, you'll want to look at M-I-S-O, which is the Midwest. And for you in Missouri, you would probably want to look at the Illinois and Arkansas hubs. Their projected prices for the day ahead is a little different. Up here in Wisconsin, I usually look at Minnesota and maybe Illinois. Michigan's kind of irrelevant because the lower part of Michigan isn't wired to Wisconsin directly.
Hmm.
So that's where you can look up numbers on how much people are using electricity and when they get the outrageous price spikes, like $140 per unit, versus $1,000 a unit in California or Texas or somewhere else.
So it's energyonline.com/data, did you
say? All run together. And this is also critical for poultry farmers who have lights on. You know, so if they're trying to get 16 or 18 hours of light a day, let the lights stay off at sundown and then turn them on maybe at 10 or 12, 10 p.m. or 12 midnight. And run through until the morning.
That's a good pointer. That's really interesting. That's definitely a good pointer for folks because the nights are really a great time to have them on anyway because the grow lights aren't really the best to be around unless you have special glasses on anyway. They're really bright and hard on the eyes. So running them overnight really makes sense.
Yeah. Ron, thank you so much. EnergyOnline.com/data. There we go.
Yeah, that's great. That's definitely important to keep an eye on.
Tom in Dodge County, let's go to you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My wife and I, for the past 35 years, have had cats. And, of course, cats love catnip. So we began growing it, and we were buying the plants from our local nursery. This year, I have started catnip in small peat pots under grow light lamps. Currently, I have the lamps on for about 8 hours a day. Can I keep those lamps on longer?
Definitely, yeah. Catnip, you should be able to leave it on as long or as little as you like, you know, as long as you don't go under 6 hours or so.
So how do you keep the cats away from the catnip while it's growing?
Yeah. We live in a large home. It's just the two of us now, and I converted one of the bedrooms to a plant room. I have a rack which got three shelves right now with two trays on each shelf, and I've got three LED grow light lamps on each shelf. So some of them, they're doing pretty well so far. In fact, I had to trim a couple of them back because they were getting kind of tall. When I started doing this, I was just astonished on how small those seeds are. They're smaller than a grain of pepper.
Yeah. Isn't it a miracle, Jer Gettle, that we've got a seed that small, and there are other plants with seeds that are just almost microscopic, and yet they can produce these wonderful plants.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, and I think that's kind of what fascinated me to, you know, gardening, is watching that little tiny seed in like 30 days become a plant, you know, a major plant. So it's incredible, amazing.
Well, Tom, you've got a good thing going there. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Jer Gettle, our guest today, he started Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, produced the first catalog when he was 17 years old. And now it's the whole seed catalog from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. And we're talking with him, obviously, about the seeds and taking a lot of questions just about general gardening. And I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Having some fun on this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Jer Gettle, who is the chief operating officer, I guess we could say. We'll put a fancy title on it for you, Jer, of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. And wonderful having him with us today as we talk heirlooms and we talk gardening with him. As you can tell, he knows an awful lot. Give a call with your questions or comments or maybe an experience to share at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jean in Green Bay, we will turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my phone call. So I've loved the catalog. It is amazing, and I've learned so much just by looking through it. But the question I have is, I believe that there's an event that the farm is going to be having done in Missouri in the beginning of May. Could your guest speak a little bit about what that event is about?
Yeah, we mentioned early on, but let's get into more detail.
Yeah, the event we have here in Missouri is basically just a celebration of spring and gardening. We have a lot of different speakers and vendors. We have about 170 different vendors from all over the Midwest. People come, a lot of them camp out, some stay in hotels or with friends. And it's a 2-day, all-day event, and the evenings, a lot of people will sit down at their campsites and gather around the campfire and tell stories. And we have a seed swap. We have people with just all sorts of old-time crafts and arts. And it's a beautiful time of year to be in the Ozarks. Everything is coming to life. Everything's blooming everywhere. And it's a kind of a celebration of seed saving and gardening and spring in general. And definitely a place where people come and share an interest in, you know, organic food and agriculture and farming and seeds and gardening. And basically, it's just a big celebration of everything spring.
And there's lots of music and lots of food.
We have music and food and lots and lots of old times arts and crafts going on. So every year it grows some and more people come to it. It's a really fun event, whether you want to camp out or just come for the day.
And you have more information about it on your website.
We do at rareseeds.com. You can actually go and click on festivals there and learn more about our different festivals that we host in Missouri and in California. And there's also a little video you can watch, kind of see what's happening at the spring festival.
Rareseeds.com. There you go, Jeannie. You going to maybe think about going?
Yeah, actually, I think a few of my friends and I are going to come on down. I am really bad at starting seeds. I have never had any success in starting seeds. And so, and with all the different varieties in your catalog, I was really hoping to find some started seeds of some of those species that I'd really love to try in my garden.
There's probably about close to, we have 170 different vendors. There's probably about half of those are selling plants. So you're probably talking about 80 or 90 vendors selling plants. So there's a big variety. There's probably in the neighborhood are 5,000 different types of plants, I'm guessing, just a guess. I mean, it's really hard to know, but there's more than what we actually have in the catalog. You know, there's people with ornamental plants and house plants to fruit trees and berry bushes to, you know, on and on. Every kind of plant you can pretty much imagine.
So there you go, Gene. Good luck. Hey, have some fun. Have some fun while you're there. Appreciate it very much. Well, Mike in Twin Lakes, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing today? Great show you got there. Listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
I got one quick question, and it bugs me. I've been raising little farm stuff all the time, but I want to know from your guest the best flavorful grown tomato. All these hybrids and stuff, and in fact, I drive truck and deliver produce, and they have a big thing about fine ripened tomatoes. None of them have any flavor anymore. What would he recommend as the best old-fashioned flavorful tomato? I don't care how long it lasts. I'm not going to can it. I'm going to go out in the garden and eat it.
Well, that's a good question. That's one we hear a lot, and it's really hard for us to pick what is our favorite tomato. It kind of depends on the color. For a red tomato, I think my favorite one is probably the Abe Lincoln original tomato. But overall, the majority of our customers probably the number one, it's really hard. Cherokee Purple or any of the dark colored tomatoes are probably our most popular for people that want a rich old time tomato flavor, because the darker the color in the tomato, it tends to have more flavor. So the dark red, dark purple, the purplish red ones tend to like Cherokee Purple. But as far as for a small salad type tomato, my favorite is the Lucky Tiger tomato, which is actually a green tomato that's blushed with red and yellow, but it has an intense flavor. But it's for like a big standard beefsteak tomato, black creme or Cherokee Purple, or like the Abe Lincoln tomato is really good tasting. But it's really hard because there's so many different people that like different tomatoes. I mean, it's a really hard question.
You know, you've got a great little feature on the Wild Tomato Man in your catalog, Brad Gates. He owns Wild Boar Farms in St. Helena, California?
Correct, yeah, and he has a lot of really good-tasting tomatoes, especially really wild, colorful tomatoes and intense, really good flavors. Some of his tomatoes have won best-tasting tomatoes several times at different tomato taste tests. So if you're looking for kind of a classic tomato taste, I'd say probably like the Cherokee Purple or like the Abe Lincoln. If you're looking for something that's really fruity and really sweet, the Brad's Atomic Grape is great. It's a tomato that's really colorful. It's actually our best-selling tomato. It has a combination of colors. It's red and orange and green and purple all kind of fused together over one tomato. And we sell more of that than any other tomato that we've ever sold, actually, in the history of the catalog, the Atomic Grape tomato.
Atomic Grape tomato. Oh, I got to look it up in the catalog here.
I think people like it because it's super sweet and super colorful. A lot of people want a really sweet tomato for, like, snacking. That one's about one of the highest. That one and the the Lucky Tiger are probably our two most popular snacky tomatoes.
So there you go, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Graham in Arlington. Hi, Graham.
Hi, I've got a question about soil amendments. So I know that a lot of people use peat moss because it aerates the soil a little and increases the water holding capacity. But I also know that it's usually mined out of bogs, and it only grows at about a millimeter per year. So once a bog is mined out, it's going to be gone for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so I was wondering if you could suggest alternatives to peat moss like coco coir or other things like that.
We have used the coconut before, but currently we're using the peat moss-based product because we can get it recycled, and it's from a place that's growing the microgreens. So basically we're getting it for almost free, and it's going to go to waste anyway. So we're basically taking their waste product and recycling that. So that's currently what we're using. But it's definitely not one of the best products. For starting plants, though, it's really hard to find something that's like local. I mean, coconut comes from a long ways away. It has a lot of shipping. The peat moss comes from a distance as well, not as far, but it has its environmental impacts as well. So for starting plants indoors, it's really hard to find something that's loose enough that can be homemade. I don't know of a really good product right now. I mean, regular garden soil is way too heavy for, you know, putting in a container. So a local product, I don't know of anything. As far as in garden beds outdoors, what we usually use if we didn't have this recycled product is we use just compost and sand and mixed with garden soil in our raised beds outdoors. If we don't actually use peat moss in those, unless we, you know, get a source where we get it free.
All right. There you go, Graham. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Mai in Appleton next. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for accepting my call. My question is, if I get a sweet or yam potato from the store and let it bud, can I grow from that? And how long would it take to rip the labor?
How long will it take to mature?
Yes.
If you get one from the store, the challenge is for growing sweet potatoes is getting one that will produce quickly. Sometimes sweet potatoes will take a while, so I would get several and get them going as soon as you can. But you should be able to get sweet potatoes. If you get the sweet potatoes started right away, you should be able to harvest the sweet potatoes whenever frost is. So, you know, it would take probably, if you plant them out like late May, you should be able to harvest them late September or early October.
Yeah. That's basically about right for Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. So thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Robert in Milwaukee wanted to talk, mention at least, that the electrical discount is available only if you sign up for it with your electrical electric company. It's best to call them directly, but you can do that—a quick call—and then you'll have access to those electric discounts that our caller earlier was talking about. So, a good point there. You know, I'm looking at these at your catalog, and I'm thinking I would love to grow half of these. But one that really caught my eye was the super warted pumpkin of Morocco. Which looks,
yep.
Well, could you describe how it's a pumpkin, but it looks like it's got, well.
Yeah, it just looks like it has huge kind of warts protruding out of the whole thing. It's really, really the Musquet de Maroc. It has a French name. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's super warted, and they vary. Each one's a little different. Some of them will be green warts. Some of them will be brown warts or orange warts. But they're a really beautiful, beautiful pumpkin for fall decorations. A lot of the warted pumpkins really make them really the coolest decorating pumpkins. Plus, it tastes good. It has a nice orange flesh.
Oh, and so that particular pumpkin could grow in at least some parts of Wisconsin, I would think.
As long as you're in Zone 5. Zone 4 might be pushing it. It's the same family as butternut. So, yeah, it's Zone 4, if you have a warm summer, would do it. But it's Zone 5, Zone 6, Zone 7 is great. But Zone 4 is on the edge.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I'd like to try that one for sure because it is the coolest looking warted pumpkin I've ever seen in my life. And it came from Morocco as well.
One of our growers is in the Madison area that grows seed for us, and he does okay with this type of pumpkin, but they tend to be a little bit lighter producers than, you know, some of the other types like the Hubbards or the Red Curries or some of the other types of pumpkins.
Well, if I could just get a couple of nice ones, I'd be happy with it, to be perfectly honest, because they really look cool. Oh, my goodness me. We are talking today with Jared Gettle. Been growing things since he was a little kid. At 17, he printed his first Baker Creek heirloom seed catalog, and my goodness, what has happened since then? It's grown to the point where he offers nearly 2,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs, and it is the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the United States. His website, rareseeds.com, is a place you can go to learn some more about it. Jer Gettle, our guest, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. They offer nearly 2,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers as well, herbs as well. It's the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the U.S. So, what varieties of heirlooms do you like to grow or eat? Have questions about your gardening? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Phil in Mount Horeb emailed us, Jer, and wonders if you have a suggestion for what he can mix with soil in his large planters. He has some large planters as a filler. Is vermiculite a good option?
You could use vermiculite. You can use compost. We use a lot of just, if you have a lot of like leaves in your yard that you can compost, or if you can get like some semi-composted like stuff from your local city or local area, like the tree trimmings and all of that that's been chopped up into ground into like little chips. If that's been aged for a year or so, that's great to mix in. Any kind of organic matter that's been chopped up fine, that's been aged a little bit, is great to mix in. Pretty much anything, you know, that's been aged a little bit, like, you know, straw, even like if you have some old straw or hay, that works great to mix in the soil. I would just kind of find what you have. Start out with what you can find locally. And if you can't find anything, you can always use, you know, vermiculite or peat moss or whatever you have to, you know, in your containers if you can't find anything. But I would start out with, you know, as much as you can using composted materials. It actually is better than soil as much as you can put in there because it makes a looser yeah. pot. And then you can always mix it with vermiculite or peat moss or whatever you have to.
Yeah, makes sense. Stella in Sturgeon Bay has something that might relate to this. Hi, Stella.
Hi. What my husband does for starting our seeds, and we have 8 chickens. We have a backyard flock, we have a large pen for them for the winter, and we go around and we collect our neighbors' leaves. We take all of our leaves and our neighbors' leaves. We fill the pen about mid-thigh high with leaves in the fall.
Yeah,
and then we put straw on top because the chickens like straw, but they scratch down through the leaves looking for bugs and stuff. And all winter long, they scratch and they poop and they scratch and they poop, and we add more straw. And then in the spring, he cleans out the pen, composts that over the summer, turning it several times, and then uses that compost for starting our seeds in the spring. And he said that he uses just about a quarter of an inch of coir on the top of the pot because there's less damping off when you do that, but it's a very tiny amount of the coir that he uses, and basically it's just we're starting seeds in our composted leaves and straw, composted with chicken poop.
Yeah.
And I wanted to also share a story, if I might. When we lived in Marion, we we were having trouble with rabbits eating our bean and pea plants.
Yeah.
We planted white clover in the paths, in the paths in the garden, and we observed rabbits sitting there next to bean plants, next to pea plants, eating the white clover. And it not only did it solve the problem of the rabbits eating the plants we wanted, but it also fixes nitrogen in the soil. So then the next year when those aisles are the rows, the soil's been nicely enriched.
Well,
that's a great idea.
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting ideas. Well, not everybody can have 8 or 10 chickens, but what do you think about that system that Stella and her husband use?
It definitely sounds good. There's just lots of little tricks like that. I mean, talk with your neighbors and talk with, gardeners in your area. You can learn so much, and we all just keep sharing ideas. There's so much you can pick up every day, by keeping your eyes and ears open, and also just testing stuff on your own like you guys did.
And it's one of the cool things about this program, the Garden Talk Show, every Friday, and it re-airs on Saturday mornings starting at 6, is the number of people who call in with their own experiences, their own ideas about how they've done things that worked. And like you say, you're sharing those ideas, and I've learned an awful lot over time about gardening just from our callers, let alone the guests.
Yeah, it's definitely amazing how many different little things that you can learn from so many people in so many different places.
Bob in Wanakee wondered, what's the best method for storing seeds?
Basically, keeping them cool and dry. They generally will store for many years just at room temperature even. But if you want to keep them for a long, long term, you want to keep them for 20 years, it's better to dry them out really well and put them in an airtight container and put them in a refrigerator or a freezer, ideally a freezer. But even in the room temperature in your house, we've had tomato seeds last, 15, 16, 17, 18 years. So, it's not unusual to have seeds last a long time, just even in room temperature. So the main thing is not letting your seeds get too hot, like putting them in a sunny window in a jar where it's going to get 140. and also not, keeping them damp. They need to be dry. They need to stay dry until it's time to plant them. But other than that, they're not really that picky.
Questions for our guest today, or maybe an experience to share. Jer Gettle, our guest today of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. The catalog itself is beautiful, as I've said a couple of times here. It must be a lot. Well, it's got to be expensive to produce. I know you, as we said, you charge about $10 for it, and you can get it in many places. But it not only looks good, but it's really interesting to read. Talk about the process of creating it.
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit of work. It's basically year-round. We are always working on stories and research. And then just continuously from about June on, whenever we have a spare moment, we start working on laying out the pages for the big catalog. And then as soon as we get that one done, we work on the second catalog. So it's always definitely something that almost a year-round process.
Oh, man. We've talked about zones and so forth. And on your website, you have a great reference tool, a growing guide. So tell us about it.
On our growing guide on our website, we actually had been working the last few years just coming up with all the instructions. And so we decided to just about 2 or 3 years ago put all of that. We actually have several different – we had an original growing guide, but we made one for each crop now where we have a little article where people can go on our website. And we're also working on video growing guides as well as videos about the history of each variety. So on our YouTube channel – people can go on and get a daily video telling the story of a different variety. And some days we'll have growing tips as well. So we're trying to increase our reach as far as how many different people have information on growing tips and so forth, and also just the stories of varieties, whether it's on YouTube or our website, as well as on Facebook.
Yeah, it's amazing. Mary in Cedarburg has something for us. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, you're talking about seed collecting. My husband has a really good method that I actually found online. He has a three-ring binder, and then the pages that you used to collect baseball cards with, go and get a bunch of those, and then you can order online little Ziploc bags that are like an inch by 2 inches maybe.
Yeah.
And then he'll take all the seed packets, he'll cut off like the back that says all the information, puts that in one side, and then right behind it puts the little bag of seeds. So then he has pages, and he can sort them by tomatoes and, you know, different vegetables that he has. And then they're in a book, and it's just really handy.
Wow. That sounds like a great idea.
Everybody that has seen it loves it, and unfortunately, he's up to 4 books now.
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool.
That is very cool. I love it. Thank you, Mary, for calling and sharing that. I really appreciate it. Wow, what a great idea. And there's... And, you know, there's also the memories and the history. As you look at those, it's probably got a I'm sure for Mary and her husband, there's a lot of great stories that aren't written down, but they can recall from the various seeds and the various vegetables and flowers and so forth that they have in those books. Wonderful story. Ed in Sheboygan, we'll go to you next. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Hey, I'm wondering if... shredded paper would be acceptable to use, like as a mulch or a soil amendment.
A lot of people use paper as long as it's not coated, you know, paper. So like, you know, like plain newsprint or cardboard. A lot of people use those for mulch and for soil amendment. The only challenge is, you know, is making sure you keep it down as a mulch until it gets wet. It can, and when it dries out, it can sometimes blow away. But, that's the only sometimes challenge with using it as a mulch. But once it gets wet and gets some soil on it, it tends to stick to the ground. But ground into the soil, it's great for, you know, loosening up the soil.
Yeah. So there you go, Ed. Go ahead and use it. Well, you talked about your some of the favorite tomatoes seeds that you have. Talk about some of the other most popular seeds that you have in your collection that you sell.
This year, our second most popular seed that we're offering is the Chinese pink celery. People just are crazy about a pink-colored celery. It's a bright pink stem. It grows really easily, too. We have actually we have a nice long row of it in the greenhouse right now. It has amazing flavor, and it grows quicker than other celeries, and it tends to take the warm weather better, too. So it's super popular. People also love New Mexico State University came out with several colored peppers a number of years ago, and we're offering them this year. They're colored jalapeno peppers, like we have lemon spice, orange spice, and pumpkin spice. So it's basically jalapeno peppers, but in these bright, citrusy colors and really sweet, sweet hot flavors. So those are some of our top ones this year. But anything, any of the Chinese vegetables have been really popular with our customers, like the bok choy, the purple bok choy, the green bok choy. People are into the leafy Asian greens, I guess, is our biggest trend this year. Whether it's the celery or the bok choys, the Chinese cabbages, the kales, but in particular bok choys and the different leafy Asian greens have been our biggest new trend this year.
And what about on the flower side?
Flower side, zinnias and sunflowers and poppies always kind of rule the flower planting. As far as we go, people love the big, full poppies. They love the zinnias, and they love anything big in flowers. The giant coxcomb, any kind of the little, minute, tiny little flowers. Yeah. Our customers, they seem to... avoid those more and more and go for the big, bold things like sunflowers. And they want things that make a big splash of color. I still like both, but it's really hard to sell the little tiny ones compared to, you know, the big, bold, splashy ones.
Yeah, makes sense. Margie in Bangor, we will turn to you now.
Well, I have a big question. I grew up in Illinois. I'm a country girl, and we had big gardens, and Mom always grew huckleberry plants. We put the seeds right out in the garden, and we froze them, and I'm missing so much huckleberry pie. In the last 2 years, I had trouble finding some seeds, and I've tried planting them here and planting them really shallow even. I can't get one plant to grow. What am I doing wrong?
Are they not coming up, or are they just not growing?
They're not doing anything.
So they're not even germinating for you. That's strange. They should be able. You should be able to start them just like you would tomatoes, and they should come right up. We actually have some nice, like, 8-inch plants right now in the greenhouse. It shouldn't be. I don't know what you'd be. They just need. They need plenty of heat, and they need some light when they're growing. Other than that, I don't know what you would be doing wrong.
So you actually sell huckleberry seeds from your catalog?
Well, they're called garden huckleberry. What we offer, and it's used for pies. Traditionally, was used for pies. The Amish in our area still use them a lot for making pies and desserts.
So, Margie, maybe a chance to purchase some from Jer Gettle here in Baker Creek Heirloom. And actually, if she went online, would she get some at your site? Would she get some information on the particular variety?
We don't really have any particular growing information other than we just grow them exactly like tomatoes. So you can also direct seed them in your garden as well. I mean, we've done that before. They grow relatively quick. It will shorten your season, though, if you direct seed them as far as how long you'll harvest them. But in general, we've never had any problem. I don't know if it's the seed or if it would be some condition. It's really hard to know on that what would be causing the problem.
Yeah. Margie, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You still garden with your family, by the way, for fun, Jer, or for your own food, or how do you do it?
We do, yeah. We grow. I'm always out every day, you know, doing even in the winter, doing a little bit in the greenhouses. But in the spring and summer months, when the seed season slows down, I'm out, you know, pretty much a half a day or so every day in the garden and around the farm.
And you have, we've talked about the festival in May, the big festivals, but you have something going on virtually every month, do you not? Talk about some of those items.
We do, yeah. We have a monthly heritage festival here at the place where people get together and we'll have some music and people come out and see the farm and do tours of the farm and the greenhouse and our warehouses. And people are, by the way, if they're in the area, we welcome people to stop by and take a tour of our place, stop by and see our farm. And also we have a restaurant open for lunch here at the farm. So come and stop in and say hi. But if you're not, you know, if you're not in the area that often, if nothing else, try to make it to the big May festival if you can. But if you're coming through Missouri for any reason, stop by.
And you've really, and you've talked about, or just sort of mentioned in passing, people from your organization in California. So you've recently expanded to both coasts. Where are you located?
We have a location in Petaluma, California, and then right up the road, about 10 miles away, we have the National Heirloom Expo that we help host in the Sonoma County Fairgrounds in Sonoma County, California. So we're located basically right north of San Francisco, about an hour.
And you mentioned you have somebody right here in Wisconsin, actually in Madison, that does some seed work for you. Or
yeah, actually,
you.
Up at Mount Horeb, Aaron Whaley, who is actually the son of the founder of Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa. He grows a lot of seeds for us and others. But he's one of our favorite seed growers. Really good seed grower and producer of bulk seeds there in Wisconsin. And there's several others in Wisconsin, too. I can't remember where they're located, though.
Brian in Oconto County emailed to ask why you don't carry Scotch bonnet peppers, and what is hotter, the Carolina Reaper or the Apocalypse Scorpion? The Apocalypse Scorpion, and what's the difference?
Yeah, on the Scotch bonnet, we're actually working on several strains this year. We've carried it in the past, but we're our seed supplier that was growing the seeds didn't have seeds this current year, I believe, but we will have Scotch bonnet back. We're just working on several strains, trying to decide which one we want to offer. And then on the, as far as I know, the Carolina Reaper is still the hottest pepper according to the world records, but There's several contenders that could potentially be hotter, but as far as I know, that's still the number one, official number one is the Carolina Reaper.
But I tell you what, for a name, Apocalypse Scorpion has got it beat when it comes to name.
And it tests really high as well, but here in Missouri, we sent some off to be tested, and it wasn't quite as hot as the Carolina Reaper. But again, conditions play so much into the scenario, so we don't know. I mean, if we would have sent the Carolina Reaper off from here in Missouri, you know, each year and the growing conditions can affect the heat level so much.
Well, a Carolina Reaper, how would you even use it, or how much would you use in any kind of a dish?
Well, I don't really use it, but a lot of our customers do. One of our employees here makes a hot sauce out of it, and all I can take is one drop. That's all I can take for my whole meal. But I'm more of a habanero, jalapeno. That's where I like that nice, mild, and medium heat. I'm not into the I don't mind it, but I use so little of the pepper. I like to be able to use a whole pepper or several whole peppers, not just a tiny little piece off of a pepper in a dish.
You know, I spent a while back at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad. And I'm telling you, they like their food hot there.
And yeah, it's an amazing place. Some of our people went there about 2 years ago, two of the ladies that work here for us, our warehouse manager, and they were researching hot peppers and meeting different farmers, and it was definitely an experience.
I can tell you, it was really a lot of fun, but I learned to be careful about how much of the pepper sauce, as they called it, that you would put on a sandwich or whatever. You could be in some trouble all day long.
Yeah, the world's former hot, you know, record pepper, the Trinidad Scorpion, comes from there. So it was the former, it was the ghost pepper or Butte Jalokia from India, and then Trinidad Scorpion took over as the world's record, and now it's Carolina Reaper, but that won't be long. There's other peppers that I'm sure are already hotter.
Well, just here, we got a minute or so left. Can you tell us again, how do people... The catalog, the whole seed catalog, you'll see it in bookstores and places for sure.
Correct. And, as far as getting a hold of us, you can search us on Facebook and also go to our website, rareseeds.com. But we'd love to, love to hear from folks that have questions. And, most of all, we'd love to meet people here at our farm in Missouri. I mean, we always love to meet people face-to-face or at one of our events. Or at a garden event somewhere across the country. We'll be here and there across the country from here and there, and we'd love to catch up with folks.
Well, I can tell you right now, I can assure you that there'll be a contingent from Wisconsin visiting you in May, and I know they're going to have a good time. Jer Gettle, thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Jer Gettle is the owner of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. He's got the Baker's Creek Heirloom Seed Catalog, wonderful catalog. And you're going to enjoy visiting Missouri, and you're going to enjoy that catalog. Thanks so much to him. And thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.